Before we begin today's episode, I wanted to ask you a question. If building a personal brand is such a pivotal part of our business success, why do so many of us find it so uncomfortable? The reality is, attention has become the most scarce commodity. And if you can't grab the attention of your ideal audience or customers, it's game over. So how can you get to be more known, liked, and trusted in your industry if the very idea of putting yourself out there terrifies you, or that you don't want to be spending millions of dollars in marketing each year? The answer is, you need to become the spotlight in your industry. Over the years, I've had the pleasure to interview some of the most inspiring, purpose-driven, and successful individuals who've defined success on their own terms. And I've identified five principles that they live by. And it turns out that you can absolutely live by these principles too, to help you grow your business, your impact, and your influence. Now, if you'd like to go and take the test, it's free. It takes under 3 minutes, and you can get it at www.becomethespotlight.com. What I love about this is it's going to give you a quick snapshot overview in the five different areas of your life, of your business, that you need to improve right now in order to better engage and enroll your ideal customers with your message, your story, and your mission. So if you're tired of being the best kept secret and you want to do it in a way that feels congruent to who you are and how you show up in the world, take the test today. www.becomethespotlight.com. I can't wait to see what results you get. Hi, and welcome to the Unconventionalist Podcast. I'm your host, Mark LaRouste, and this is a show about what it's really like to turn your message into movement, where I get to sit down in each episode across an inspiring guest to hear more about their journeys, the ups and the downs, and the lessons learned from both. Today's conversation is a powerful one, and a word of warning. We talk about some uncomfortable conversations, some sensitive topics such as childhood trauma and child abuse. So please take care of your needs. If this is an episode you want to skip, that's totally cool. Or you may want to wear some headphones and listen to this when the kids are out of the room. That being said, I am extremely honored and humbled to introduce you to Boyd Varty, who is the author of The Lion's Tracker's Guide to Life. And he is a South African-born healer. I mean, that's the only word I could use, who turned his skills from tracking lions to tracking our own life paths. And we dove deep into the subject of how do we express our true authentic selves, what gets in the way, whether that's from social paradigms telling us of what success should be, to how do we identify our actual life track, what are some of the tools and some signals, and how the space and everyone's giving us clues. So it's a powerful conversation. You won't want to miss this. You'll definitely want to take some notes, so get your notebooks out. But we also hear about the incredible story of how Boyd's family healed the land on which they built this safari sanctuary to reconnect with nature and animals. And really, it's a metaphor for life. It's a metaphor for us. So if you enjoyed today's conversation, please share it with one friend who needs to hear this. As always, I really appreciate it if you leave a rating and review over on Apple Podcast. It just generally helps spread the word and impact more people. And if you're listening to this over on YouTube or Spotify, you can subscribe to there too. So without further ado, I give you the one and only Boyd Varty. Boyd, welcome to the show. Huge honor to have you, and generally super excited. And I feel like you're the only guest who I could ever kick off my episode by saying Kunjani Mfowethu, which I haven't said in many years.
Amukele Mfowethu. I'm happy to know you. That's very good. Your first Shangaan introduction.
I lived in South Africa for 6 months, and it was truly one of the special places I've lived in the world. I've lived in a few places. And I feel, and I don't know if this is something you felt now that you've traveled and you live in the States as well, around the spirits of South Africa and the spirit that happens when you're on the continent. And there's a weird thing that people used to tell me, that when you live in Africa, and I lived in the Gambia, I lived in South Africa, there's a sense of belonging and there's a sense of coming home, which I always thought that was crazy and weird, but having experienced that, I can speak to it. Is that something that you've kind of experienced, or that you've found people relate back to you in some way?
I mean, I've seen it countless times, you know, in one of my lives as a safari guide. Just, and this overwhelming sense of people from all over the world, you know, feeling connected on two levels. The one is in South Africa and in Africa in general, what you experience is a much more collective consciousness, what I would think of as a we consciousness rather than an I consciousness. In South Africa, they even have a word for it. There's a term in Southern Africa and all over Africa, really, that's referred to as Ubuntu. And
yes.
Ubuntu is the idea
when
that...
when you do better, I do better, or something like that.
I am because of you. Through our interactions with other people, we get to experience the deepest parts of our own humanity. And I've actually sort of expanded that. You know, Africa is one of the places where you can still land somewhere and have encounters with, you know, an incredible plethora of wild animals. And so, you know, I would say that it's not just through other people, but through all encounters with sentient life that we experience ourselves more humanely. And when we feel that, there is a feeling of being more ourselves, and that is a kind of a feeling of coming home. And, you know, I would also say that a lot of the depression and anxiety that we are seeing in modern life now is what I would consider an undiagnosed homesickness for the feeling of being connected and in the state of connection with nature and with each other. And without that, it's hard to know yourself when you don't feel those fundamental ties of what make us human, a connection to a place, connection to the rhythms of a place, and a connection to a community. And as we lose that, we become more anxious and depressed. In Africa, it's built in. The people are all operating in a much more, you know, if you do well, I do well. If you're suffering, I'm suffering, because that's how people grow up, in collective village consciousness. So absolutely.
Yeah. And I can speak to that. I remember a friend of mine who was trying to explain to me about when she was growing up in a community in West Africa, around how she could never mess up in front of her uncles and neighbors because everybody acted like her parent. So it was like this kind of like this idea that it takes a village to raise a child, but it was really this idea that she couldn't hide or get away with anything because everybody would step up and act as if they were her mom or her dad, regardless of bloodline. And that's something that stuck with me, around the sense of community. So look, I've got so much we could talk about. Like, I'm generally super stoked. I heard your conversation on Aubrey Marcus podcast, and that was thanks to Daniel Nichols, who's been listening to this. He sends out a newsletter with curated shows or podcasts, and you were one of them. He featured you and he was like, this is a show I've listened twice. And I was like, okay, let me check. And I listened to it, and it was just like this incredible mix of storytelling with coming home. And again, it's funny, we started off by coming home as a physical place, but also coming home to self. And I know that this might be painful for you to do again, but I do believe that those who have never heard about you, we would rob the opportunity to get a bit more of an insight into how you ended up being where you are today if we didn't dive a little bit into your backstory. So if that's cool with you, I'd love to hear a bit more. And one of the beginnings is the story of how your great-great-grandfather ends up buying a destitute place of cattle farm after having a bit too much gin on the spot, and how this lineage then starts your story in some way. So do you want to take us back real quick and give us a little bit more about how that happened?
Sure. I mean, I would say that my backstory probably has three threads to it. And the first one is the remarkable impact that this piece of land that I grew up on had on me. And as you said, the story begins in 1926, when my great-grandfather drank too many gins at a tennis party, and he heard about these bankrupt cattle farms that lay in the wild eastern part of South Africa. And the reason the farms were bankrupt is because it was very difficult terrain to run cattle on, and lions were eating the cattle. And so sight unseen, with a bit of, you know, the wheels a bit greased with gin, he went down to the deeds office and he bought this property. He went there with a friend of his in the June of 1926, and there was a train that ran through the south of the property. They bribed the train driver to stop. They got off and they walked into the wilderness. And I was, you know, every time I've heard that story, from the time I heard it when I was young, I've been interested in the impulse that something in him, when everyone said that's bankrupt, wild place, something in him said, that's where I want to go. And he went there in the winter months because of malaria, and it was, you know, it was out in the middle of nowhere, and they went to hunt lions. And my great-grandfather hunted lions there, my grandfather grew up hunting lions there, and my father and uncle grew up hunting lions there. At that time, in those days, that was the mentality and the consciousness of the time. And there were animals there, and the way it's described to me is there were animals there, but you didn't see them, because a lot of the property was eye-high scrub. When the cattle had overgrazed the land, almost to protect itself, had sent up this scrub. So animals were there, but you didn't see them. And if you saw a lion or a leopard, it was desperately trying to get away from you because they had been hunted. So for three generations, that's what happened. And then my grandfather died very suddenly in 1969. And my father and uncle were 15 and 16. And in the wake of...
They were that young. They were very young. Tell the story, I didn't realize how young they were. Because I remember you saying the story that they left this disused place and they had to make a decision whether they sell, they keep. I didn't realize they were that young.
They're incredibly young. And in the wake of the loss of their father, there was a gathering in Johannesburg. All the family advisors came, and, you know, captains of industry said to my grandmother and these two teenage boys, step one, you got to get rid of that place. It's in the middle of nowhere. Hunting lions is a dangerous pastime. It's going to drain your money. Get rid of it. And my father, as a 15-year-old, stood up. And again, from this place that I'm fascinated by, somewhere deep inside of him, he said, we're going to keep that place. And someone said to him, you know, well, how do you intend to look after your mother now that the family breadwinner is lost? And he said, we'll find a way to make it pay. And that's how my family got into the safari business. And so these two 15-year-old boys started running this ramshackle safari business, and it kind of didn't work. It was just a couple of mud huts, a broken Land Rover, eye-high scrub. If you saw the odd impala or antelope, that was great. But all of that changed when they met a man called Ken Tinley. And really, this was a defining moment. Ken was a kind of maverick ecologist. He was a high school dropout who had been admitted to a biological sciences degree at the University of Cape Town because he drew a picture of a butterfly with such intricate detail that the dean of the faculty said to him, okay, you're in. And after he completed his studies, he went to do a doctorate in a wild part of Mozambique. And he lived alone for a period of time there in a reserve called Gorongosa. And during that time of solitude, Ken developed this incredible sense of how a landscape fits together and an almost spiritual connection with the land. He could feel how moisture moved through the land and how that drove different flora and how that attracted different fauna. It was as if he could feel it all moving through him. He's deeply connected. And he showed up next to the fire back at this property where I grew up, and he met these two young boys and he said, if you want this place to work, we need to restore the land. We need to partner with the animals and think of them as our kin. And we need to invite the local people to come and be a part of this restoration. And he actually showed them how to physically restore the moisture content of the land, how to clear the scrub and fix where they were losing moisture due to erosion. And that is the first part of my story, is that I grew up watching this process of restoration underway. And so somewhere deep in my own psyche, I started to see a landscape coming back to its more harmonious state after what I would think of now as the trauma of the cattle farming. And I saw the animals return. I saw them clear these huge areas.
Because just jumping in here, because one thing that, just to make it clear for people listening, right? Because I know that, you know, when you listen to it's like point A to B, but when he saw the land, as you said, it was deeply traumatized. There was nothing that indicated that this could be a fruitful land where fauna and animals and humans could flourish and come together and create an ecosystem that would self-heal. There was nothing. It wasn't like there was a sign that says, you know, hey, here you start. It was just like this deep belief and yearning that this land has what it takes to heal.
And that's where Ken was phenomenal. He looked at this sort of eye-high scrub, and where other, you know, people would have said, well, this is just how it is. He could see what was possible underneath it. It's almost like he saw the potential underneath the scrub. You know, he was looking through the landscape. And the result was that the land started to come back to life as they started to work on it, clear the scrub, and this tremendous influx of animals and a feeling on the property that a relationship was being rebuilt between people and nature. And about 10 years into that journey, a leopard appeared to my father and uncle. And it was the first time that a wild leopard there had allowed herself to be seen. And you know, she walked out onto the road.
And they're rare. I'm just jumping in just to give some context. But for those who don't understand, leopards are mega rare. I never saw one in the wild. I went to a few safari, right, and that kind of stuff, but I never saw a leopard. It's like one of the most rare species that you can see. I mean, I that's my assumption. Maybe I'm wrong, Boyd. But
no, you're right. Yeah. You'll meet South Africans who've been going to the Kruger National Park for 20 years and have never seen a leopard.
Yeah.
And up until this point, for my father and uncle, if you saw a leopard, you were trying to hunt it and it was trying to get away from you. But now something had changed as they did this work on the land. And this leopard stopped. She stopped in the road and she turned and looked at them. And she allowed herself to be seen for a moment. And then she slipped off the road. And my uncle said to my father, whatever just happened, that is my future. So again, somewhere inside of him, he knew. And he teamed up with a local Shangaan tracker. And for the next 10 years, they would go out every day and they would follow that leopard. And they began to find her more regularly. And she realized that they meant her no harm. And this incredible relationship with this wildcat, she started to allow herself to be seen. And then with time, you were able to drive a Land Rover over to her and watch her. And that was the beginning of a huge release of energy, because word got out that Londolozi, this property, was a place you could go to see wild leopards. And that just gave the place incredible momentum. And suddenly the safari business just took off.
Yeah. And what a metaphor for life. You know, like, as I hear you say this, I can't help but be touched and think, how many of us walk around as a rugged, traumatized piece of land that has all these kind of wild animals inside of us yearning to be seen and feel safe, but haven't yet come across either the guide or the permission to, you know? And I heard you once say, your healed trauma becomes your medicine. Right. And it feels like the healing of this land became the medicine for your dad, for the people around, for the animals, and for people who came to visit.
I mean, what I would say, Mark, is that it's a powerful metaphor, and it's actually the central metaphor of my life's path now. But as I watched that land restore, I saw that, a landscape healed is kind of like a person who's found a way to heal themselves. A tremendous amount of energy flows to it. You know, it became that land now is a huge economic generator for over 200 families. It is a place where animals live in safe haven. It's a place with incredible biodiversity. It's a place, you know, the act of restoring that land unleashed an incredible harmony onto the land, and with it just so much life. And that became that idea of healing, of restoration, that idea has lived inside of me deeply. And I've come to believe that the restoration of the planet will come out of restoring of wild places, but it'll also come out of many, many individuals finding out how to heal themselves, finding out how to release their trauma, finding what I would call their unique medicine way, or what I think of now as the track of your life. Something, you know, when you heal, when you find your harmony, something very authentic flows into you. And that authenticity is usually very original. It's very creative. It naturally has a desire to serve. So people who do that work of restoring become, you know, people who create transformation all around them. And so...
And you were on your own journey, right? Because from what I could understand, as a young boy, you trained and grew up on the land and were brought into the arts of tracking and understanding how to read the field. And that's something I thought was really brilliant about when you talk about understanding how to read the field, because the field is always speaking. The field is always talking, whether you see it or not. There are signs everywhere. And you grew up and you're tracking, you're a safari guide, but you're lost. Like, it felt there was a moment in your life, especially when your family went through a series of vicious lawsuits that were trying to financially cripple the entire foundation of what you were standing for 10 years, almost made you lose, not the will to live, I don't want to put words in, but it lost like the belief in that, what's the point, right? Like, tell us a bit about that, because I think for people listening, it's great to hear the healing end a bit, but I think that process of transformation that you went through is going to be really relevant for people listening.
Sure. I mean, so now we're moving on to some of the other threads of this story. You know, the first was this incredible land restoration. The second for me personally was, it was a few things. The first was that I was, from the time I was very young, I was mentored by these Shangaan trackers. And I learned the art form and the mentality and the psyche of what it takes to follow an animal across a landscape. And I learned the principles. I learned how to do that. And so I had this deep understanding of the art form of tracking. And then when I was about, it began when I was about 17 years old, my family went through a series of, you know, tremendous traumas. We were physically attacked and taken hostage in Johannesburg during a very difficult time in South Africa's history. I was, in that same year, I was badly physically injured on my leg when I got bitten by a crocodile. And we got involved in this court case, which was basically a raid. They were trying to sue us so that they could claim our assets and take the land, basically. The idea was that they would sue us until we ran out of money, and then they would claim our assets. So it was a very hostile type of, it was a raid, really. Yeah. And so by the time I was 23, I was dealing with all of that, and I had become, you know, incredibly jaded. And a court case has a very unique type of strain to it, because it's very hard to understand what's going on. It changes every day. Lawyers are always working angles, and you live on the brink of losing everything, and it's just costing huge amounts of money to try and even just stay there. So the stress is unspeakable. And so that's where I found myself at age 23, and the result of all of that was I was totally shut down, and I'd become extremely just frozen inside and traumatized. And at that time, I was working as a safari guide, and I met a woman who came on safari, and I was her guide. I was taking her out, but instantly I felt a kind of rapport with her. We found ourselves in interesting conversation, and she said to me, "The restoration of the planet will come out of a transformation in human consciousness." And I remember driving my Land Rover and feeling like.
But one of the stories behind that, which I thought was amazing, is that when you saw her name on the board, you erased the name of the guy that was supposed to be assigned to her, and you put your name instead.
Yeah, so in the ranger's room, in the guide's room, there was a board where guides would be assigned to guests who were coming in. And a friend of mine had told me he had driven her a year before. Her name was Martha Beck. He had driven her a year before, and he said, you know, she's a really cool woman. She's a martial artist. And I had a passion for the martial arts. So I thought, you know, I'd be interested in that. So I rubbed someone else's name off and I assigned myself to her. And that action radically changed my life. That one decision. And we met and I took her out. And as I said, she said to me, the restoration of the planet will come out of a shift in human consciousness. And I nearly drove the Land Rover off the road. I felt like the restoration of the land, and I felt my own life purpose just sort of like really coming together there. And then eventually on about the third or fourth day of being her guide, we had parked back at the camp and we were standing in the car park. I was standing next to the vehicle and she just looked at me and said, you know, I'm ready now to talk to you. And I sort of looked at her quizzically like, what do you mean? She said, I can see what's happening inside of you and I'm here for you. You can talk to me about it. And I was sort of taken aback. But there's a strange thing when someone really sees you, and it's almost like an authentic part of you recognizes that you are being deeply seen. And I felt that part of myself realize that she knew that what I was going through. And I just kind of broke down. And from that moment on, she became my guide. She was just this incredible healer and this just a phenomenal, what I would think of now as life tracker. She just started to guide me out of the trauma. She started to guide me out of the frozen place. And then she started to attune me slowly to what my mission and purpose was. And as she started to mentor me and guide me in that way, I started to see this childhood living as a tracker. I started to see that she was doing the same thing, just in a different terrain. But the principles of transformation, the way of the tracker was really the same. She was finding specific things. She was teaching me to attune to a certain trail. and she was helping me, sort of guiding me onto that track. And so a long way to say, Mark, that my life came together between the restoration of a wild place, the path of a tracker, and then my own healing and discovering that the way of a tracker could be applied to transformational processes, to healing processes, the psyche, the approach of the tracker, could all be put together. And all of my work now is around what I would call the restoration. And it involves helping people deeply find the track of their life, their authentic purpose. And when they do that, they become a part of a transformation in consciousness that will change our relationship with ourself and with nature. And so those are the strands.
Powerful stuff, man. Super powerful stuff. So you spoke about something which landed deeply with me when you said those words. It's like there's something very special and unique when someone truly sees you. Right, the way that she saw you, the way that Ken saw the land. Speak about that feeling for a second of people listening to this who may or not be able to resonate with this yet or get that yet. But when you come across an opportunity to be truly seen authentically, vulnerably, what's available there and why is that so scary?
Well, one of the art forms of being a healer is to, like Ken, looking at the land and looking through it to what was more essentially there. I'll say it like this. Most of us are made up of two parts. There is a deeply essential, what I would call wild self inside of us, something that you might think of it almost as DNA code. It's your harmony, your uniqueness. It's what you're here to do, and it's built into you. And then overlaying that sort of unique, central, essential nature is a social self, which, you know, is usually full of the things that I should do or have to do to be successful. You might also think of it as cultural programming. If I do this, I'll be happy. The ideals of the culture. If I succeed in this way, I'll finally feel good. Then I can feel good about myself. There's all these things that are presented to us, programming, how we think we, social construct. But also overlaying that is trauma. You know, the things that happened, you know, trauma you might define as things that happened that shouldn't have happened, or things that didn't happen that should have happened. You know, they sort of fall into those two categories. And so that trauma also sits on top of us and freezes us. And what happens is that when you are seen through that, there's something very human that happens when someone looks through your social conditioning that you've become unaware of, when they look through the trauma that has become such a part of your life that you don't even know you've gone blind to it, and sees you and holds you in a vision of what you truly are. Something inside of you recognizes it, and that's what's quite amazing about it. It's not rational. When someone truly sees you, it's not like you rationally understand, oh, they really see me. There's a feeling to it. There's something undeniable, kind of like, you know, when you know you're falling in love with someone. Like, it's not a rational state. It's just something is happening between us that is beyond the rational. And when that happens, it triggers what I call essential wisdom. It triggers a knowing inside of you of what is possible from the truest place inside of you. And just touching that, it's almost like a wave gets set off, that once that happens, it becomes very, very hard to maintain your illusions of social and patterned, what I would call patterned self, you know? And so that's sort of the dynamic of it.
We'll get back to our conversation in just 1 minute. I really want to emphasize the power of the five principles of becoming the spotlight in your industry that I've identified over the years of dissecting and distilling the conversations I've had with some of the most inspiring and purpose-driven people who've defined success on their own terms. And I used to only make this available to my private clients and my community and my group coaching, et cetera, programs, but I'm now making that available to you because I really believe that if you can see where the problem is, you can improve it. So if you want to benchmark and see your ability to stand out and make an impact with your story, your message and mission, head over to www.becomethespotlight.com and fill out the quick questions. It'll take you 3 minutes, it's free, and it's gonna give you a snapshot overview of where you are in your business and your ability to influence, impact, those who matter most to you. It's free, it takes under 3 minutes, and it's available at www.becomethespotlight.com. Now let's get back to that conversation.
There's a previous episode that really landed with our audience. I did an episode with Tucker Max. I don't know if Aubrey's introduced him to Tucker yet. He's in Texas as well. And we talked a lot about childhood trauma. And there's two things to this part. One of them is I heard you talk about, and this is someone who trained you, who taught you into this gift of medicine, was around you could, and I don't know if this, I'm putting words in your mouth. So again, I don't want to say things if it's not the case. But I think I heard you say almost that from the way that someone laughs, the way that someone moves, talks, interacts, as a line tracker, right? Like you could track certain signs. When it comes down to humans, we give off signals all the time about maybe our trauma, maybe what we're most afraid of, what we're most afraid for the world to see. Is that something that I picked up that you said that was correct? Is that something that you kind of seen that you can tell from people when you walk into a room around, well, I can see some of the patterns that are happening here?
Yeah. So what I would say, just to give people context, is, you know, as I went through my own healing, my life as a tracker, as an animal tracker, and the awarenesses that I had developed, I started to apply them to transformational processes. And I started to do, you know, hundreds and hundreds of transformational processes. I started working in ceremonial spaces. I started working alongside a very, very talented medicine man. I worked alongside my first mentor, this woman, Martha. And as I started to run, you know, many of these processes, hundreds of them, and then thousands of them, you know, you started to be able to see that patterning that I'm talking about. You started to like really get a sense of that. And you started to quickly work out how to help people go underneath that to that more essential place. But you're 100% right. You know, one of the ways that it is said is the body keeps the score. You know, we hold everything we've been through. We hold it as psychological defense. We hold it in our body. We hold it in our outlook. And, you know, quite quickly, if you do this work a lot, you will start to see very specific, you can start to see things in the way people are approaching things, are talking about things, the way they hold themselves, the way they energetically present themselves, the tone and frequency of voice. It's all there. You know, I would say it like this: if you came to South Africa, Mark, and we went out tracking, let's say we were on the track of a rhino. You know, I'm gonna show you the track, and slowly you're going to start to pick out signs as your eye starts to become attuned to the very specific footprint of a rhino. I'm going to show you characteristics, and at first you're not going to see anything, and then slowly you're going to start to pick out some of those strange shapes, and then soon your eye is going to say, like, okay, that type of compression, that shape, that's what I'm looking for. You're learning, and then over a few days you're going to be able to start to track a rhino, whereas at first it's going to be like, I'm going to point it out to you, and you're going to be like, what am I looking at? It's exactly that. That idea is just incredibly important in all dimensions of life. There is information, but we have to teach ourselves to see it. And in hundreds of hours of ceremonies, I have taught myself to see very specifically what people are carrying, what they're holding. And then as a healer, my job is to start to bring awareness to what they're holding that they don't know they're holding, and to start to create a dynamic where they can come more into balance. So for example, someone who's been severely traumatized, usually the energy moves upward into like a fight and flight response. So if you can imagine a breath in that you hold, you know, that's a common trauma response. Now, most people are subtly, who've been very traumatized, are subtly holding that, although it's not that exaggerated, but that's kind of the energy they're holding. So then my job would be firstly to help them understand that they've been holding this for so long they don't even know they're holding it, and then to slowly start to help them move the energy downwards and ground themselves a little bit more. And the way to do that will be to start to process some of that fear from that time so that their whole system can start to drop, you know. And so it's So it's not woo-woo at all. It's creating a relational dynamic that allows them to move in a different direction with themselves and become aware of what's going on inside of them.
And what they're holding on to. Because so what we talked about on the previous episode of Tucker Max, episode 145, is so I've been going back into childhood trauma and exploring a little bit more about that. I'm trying to understand, right? And so a few events happened, but one of them was I was brought up in the French education system, and it was a very archaic system where as a kind of a young, you know, dyslexic, creative kid, I didn't really fit into the mold that was expected to sit down and study and spell right. So two specific years I spent what I would consider now as an adult with kids looking back at it, going bullying by some adults where they would humiliate me on almost on a daily basis about my lack of ability to spell and to solve exercises. And as I've done some work around this, I realized that one of the first things I had to recognize was that that was trauma. And I've never, and you know, as I, and this is like me having done a lot of work around this, I used to never consider that trauma because I was like, I wasn't raped. There wasn't someone murdered in my family. Like the, how could I call that trauma, right? Like no matter what. And then through some of the work, through Tucker explaining me around, and I love your definition of trauma, something that happened that shouldn't have, right? That's such a like a clear definition of that. But one of the things that I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this was one of the reasons why I refused to call it trauma is I was so afraid of giving power to the bullies, to the teachers, by admitting that it was traumatic, they win. Right? Like this idea that I was so holding on to this image of like, I'm not going to be a victim and I'm not going to be giving them credit. Is that something that you've seen with people who've gone through some form of trauma where the reluctance and the fear of even acknowledging that it's trauma in the first place?
I mean, absolutely. You know, there's, I mean, the first thing to understand is that, you know, normally what happens is we develop a defense pattern, and we have to come to love that defense pattern too. So with people who've been bullied, traumatized, abused, sometimes there is a defense that you don't get me. You know, you don't get, I'm just going to harden in that place so that you don't like own me in a certain way. Mm. So a version of what you're describing. What the work would do is to understand, to process what happened, firstly. So, you know, normally with what you're describing, there's what we would call an introjection into your psyche. And usually when that has been done to a young person, they've been constantly shamed. How would I describe it? A voice, you get a voice inside of you that is not your voice. It is the voice of those that shamed you. Okay, mm-hmm. So we have to become aware of that. The second
like I'm not, is, I'm not good enough. I'm stupid. Exactly. I'm not lovable.
Something
all these
critical.
Things.
Yeah. There's something wrong with me. Yeah. There's something wrong with me. So a voice that is not your voice comes into you, but it was put in you at a time that it you think it's yours because it's been there for so long.
True.
You
know, I was six
when it happened so, to yeah. you. You were so young. The second thing is you have to understand the dynamics of shame. The dynamics of shame are your own feelings are unsafe. So the way that it made you feel, you were ridiculed for, and so your own feeling became something you couldn't have, so you had to harden. Okay? So the next phase of that would be allowing yourself to feel the shame without judging it, without actually letting the shame take you over. And that's where my work as a guide is to say, you know, what happened there is not right. In any circumstance, Mark, can you think about you and I standing around looking at a six-year-old saying you're so stupid because you can't do, you know, some like little, like, you know, we know now yeah. that we would never do that. The second thing is I would guide you into saying, let yourself feel all the things you feel around that and actually soften into letting yourself feel the shame, the criticism that you've run on yourself. The next thing I would say is now together, and the together is a very important part of this. You know, we're not meant to heal alone. We're meant to have spaces where we can explore together. And that's one of the things that is lost in our society. Together, let's recast this and understand that you can soften into allowing it to be true what happened to you without any of that being shameful and without you even needing to be hardened as a defense against that shame. So that would be kind of the journey we would go on together. If we were working together in a ceremonial space to move you through something. And then what would happen is every time that voice came up that said, you're not good enough, or, you know, you would be able, at first it had just been a voice in your head. Now suddenly you would be saying, oh, there is that voice that was introjected into my psyche. Just that. Now you have an awareness that that's not me. That's something that happened that is creating a reaction inside of me. And that's how we create space. And over time, as we watch more of those things, when we watch them with love, when we become aware of them with compassion, they start to go. And a more open, clear self it takes its place. Yeah.
No, it's amazing what you're talking to, because that's exactly right. It's kind of like I realized recently that as a 36-year-old man, I was walking around as a wounded 6-year-old. Right, like basically the way that I showed up in the world, where I became an overachiever and I kept on doing a million things and won awards and accolades and blah, 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 was to prove to the world that I'm enough and that I'm lovable, right? And this fundamental truth that I am lovable, not because of what I do, but because of who I am, has never really deeply inserted. But I know that people listening to this will recognize themselves in some of that pattern around. Love what you said. First, acknowledge what it was, then go with compassion, love, and hold it, and have a space in which you can be guided so that you can start metacognition around it, saying, hey, this isn't actually the reality of just you. It's what happened. But then there's another level, and I'm curious to your thoughts on this. This is still something that I'm unpacking and dealing with, but it's like another sort of form of trauma, which is when you struggle to even figure out what it was, or you struggle to even put a label on it. If that can I share with you something? Is that okay? So just a heads up, anybody listening to this, we're about to talk about some sensitive topics that includes children, and that can be disturbing. So please take care of your needs. So this is something that recently resurfaced, and I had never really thought about. I never talked about it. I think this is the first time I ever talk about it publicly. And I don't really remember how it came about, me talking about it the first time. I think it might have been around Me Too. It might have been around my mum's friend who started talking about her neighbor's son. And I said, oh, yeah, that reminds me. So when I was around seven, right around that time, I was sitting on the swing with my best mate, Naomi, and and we were in her garden. And I remember, it's really weird, and you probably recognize this with people telling you different events. Probably you also in your life, right? When you had that trauma in Johannesburg when you were attacked. So I remember very specific details, but then I don't remember anything else. Like I don't remember where we were, like the day, what happened before, what happened after. So we're on a swing and this man comes up. And I remember, again, vaguely, so this man comes up, comes behind me. And at first starts pushing me on this swing, but Naomi didn't seem alarmed by who this man was. I had never really seen him before. And before you knew it, he started putting his hands on me and starting kissing me inappropriately and telling me things like, I know your father. I know your dad. I knew he didn't, because I'd never seen him in my life. He's like, I know your dad. I know your dad. And trying to touch me in different places, kissing me. And again, I don't remember in intrinsic detail, like what he was wearing, what he smelled like, what the voice was, but I remember the internal feeling. I remember the internal compass saying, this is wrong. This is not okay. And all I remember doing is grabbing Naomi's hand and getting out of there. I never thought about this. Never. Like I never thought about it, never talked about it, never told anyone. And if you knew me, I was the kind of kid that had a big mouth and talked about everything. So when this resurfaced, I kind of thought, I was like, well, that's nothing. It's nothing, because nothing happened. He didn't get my willy out. He didn't put his willy in my mouth. Like there was no like traumatic event. And I just struggled to put a label on it. And I'm just wondering, just to land the learning for people listening, when people go through an event like that, where they're struggling to even put a label on what it was, where they're even struggling to put what it actually means to them, what's a way that they can start exploring what that trauma might mean, how it might have showed up? because the only time I ever connected to it was when a therapist told me, imagine that was your daughter on the swing, my three-year-old daughter. And I just burst, and even now I can feel it connecting, right? Burst into tears. Like, that's not okay. It's wrong. So I hope that was okay for me to share. I'm just curious to land the learning around, like, how do we actually put labels when we can't even label trauma ourselves?
Well, I mean, just what you've done now is the way we start to work with it. You know, because it's confusing. You know, when we have a situation like the one you've just described, you know, there's something, what I hear in it is a strange double state starts to happen, which is very common when something traumatic is happening. The first is a kind of acuity of a memory in certain ways. You know, like Naomi's hand, there's certain memory acuity.
Yes.
But at the same time, there's also a dissociation. So there's sort of two things happening, which something in you has caught this and held it. And so that's the first thing that I'm aware of as you talk to me.
Mm.
The second thing is that you don't have to fully understand it right now. You know, just the way that we start to do this is we start to unpack this together. As you talk to me, it's very clear to me that whatever was going on that day was incredibly inappropriate, you know, and that's the first place that I would go is, you know, for a strange man to come up and put his hands on you, that is completely inappropriate. So that needs to be acknowledged.
And he turned out to, by the way, one thing I forgot to say is that he was the son's neighbor who was also the babysitter of Naomi and her brother. And he turned out to be a pedophile. Like, the dad came over one day and, like, years later saying, do not go anywhere near my son. We've unfortunately just found out he's a pedophile. And so that was just an extra layer of, like, oh, a pedophile laid his hands on me and it could have been much worse. Right. So that was just like an extra layer on it.
Yeah. So, you know, the way that anyone would work with it, and because people do have confusing repressed memories, people do have things that happen that they're uncertain about.
Yes. Did I make it up? Did that really happen? Was it? Yeah. You know,
and really what matters is for you to have a space where you can talk about it, have a place to simply unpack it, to be witnessed in that place, to receive support in someone helping you work it out. Like, you know, me saying to you, that's certainly inappropriate. You know, I know enough, and I've had enough encounters with that type of thing to know that is not appropriate. So sometimes, and you know, listeners might be like, obviously it's not appropriate, but if you've been inside of it and something has happened to you, you can be confused about what happened.
I used to make jokes about, like, 100% what you're saying, and you know, from the emotional spectrum, from pain to laughter often sit together, right?
Yeah.
And so I used to almost say it as a joke to the very few people I ever saw. I was like, oh yeah, and this weirdo just started putting his hands on me and touching my nipples and touching me and kissing me, and it was really weird. But I used to make, and I think the reason why I'm mentioning all this is also the idea of dissociation and how many, right? Because it goes back to the work you're doing about reconnecting people to self, reconnecting people to coming home to who they are, to their purpose, and how easy it is for all of us to be disconnected.
Absolutely. And we need, so I guess where I'm landing with it is, you know, we need a place to discover this together. That's why ceremony becomes very important, because if you sit in a really well-guided ceremony, people are able to process in ways that you just don't get access to in a very socialized life. People are able to receive physical comfort. People are able to move energy in their bodies. People are able to somatically experience what happened. People are able to, you know, almost like the other thing that's happening is while you're talking, the story is happening on one level, but I'm aware of the feeling that it created inside of you. And that's important that we understand that didn't feel good and it felt off.
Yes.
And that, so, you know, it doesn't matter whether you got away lightly or it was actually okay. You know, all this rationale that we can make around an encounter like that feeling was in you. That's something very...
That I wasn't safe. Yeah.
So we process that. And then, Mark, another thing about it is, you know, to move out of, you know, the sort of physical inappropriateness is there is also cultural trauma that we are all living with right now that is dangerous because it is such a part of the culture that we don't even realize what we are being, what we are dealing with. You know, for example, from the time you're very young, we are presented with a series of ideals, and it is a relentless presentation of ideals that the culture puts on you as a man, as a woman, as a career person. It is endless to say, and the ideal says something like, in order to be successful, do well, be worthwhile, here's what you have to achieve.
Yes, get good education, good partner, good kids, good blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, this is the level. This is what success is. And either, in my experience, two things happen. You either achieve that and you realize that that ideal doesn't really give you what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. Or you never achieve it, and there's this built-in cultural narrative that runs of like, I never quite made it.
Yes.
You know, I've done okay, but I never quite got there.
That.
I never quite. And then what happens is, and this is quite strange, it's almost like your own egoic self. If you have ideals, the thing about an ideal is an ideal exists inside of you as almost like a constant state of judgment, you know? And then at a certain point, your own ego starts holding you against that, judging you against that. So we live in a society where we end up being very critical of ourselves all the time. And it is so built in that most people don't even know what they're living with. They don't know the scope of the programming ideals.
What is
ideals.
Theirs versus what has been, like the matrix versus the core essence of their true authentic selves.
Totally. Well, and you're living with this constant programmed in ideals that you're trying to achieve, feeling like you never quite achieve them. Or if, you know, I've done work with a few billionaires, you know, that's kind of like the cultural ideal, right, of mega success. And you just work with a couple of those people and you realize, well, that ain't it. You know, what we're looking for is to find our authentic harmony. And our authentic harmony will not be defined by what is outside of us. It is actually defined by going inside of us and finding what energizes us, finding what enlivens us, finding what creates natural curiosity in us, finding what when we engage in it helps us forget about time, finding, you know, the activities and people that when we do them, something meaningful flows into our lives. And as we turn inwards and start defining that, what we want to create externally starts to change. And so it's always inside out rather than the other way around. But the whole culture will tell you outside in, work out how to be successful out there, achieve that, and then you'll feel good.
And it's hard. And I'm guessing that even you, with your level of awareness around this, you must catch yourself falling into the trap of believing that you should have more listeners, more readers, more. And I'm just curious, how do you navigate that? Like, if when you catch yourself, and if you catch yourself going, hey, boy, I just fell into the trap of the external validation. You know, like, does that still happen to you? Is that something that you still find yourself dealing with?
I mean, I think that we all live with that all the time. I think that I'm very lucky that, you know, I always have nature. So in some ways, I'm constantly just connecting into nature, and that seems to bring me into balance and help me remember where I get my energy from. But you're right. And here's what I would say. You know that, you know, the old Joseph Campbell quote of follow your bliss?
Yes.
You know, follow your bliss. And every bumper sticker, and it's quoted everywhere, follow your bliss. And no one quotes the second part of what he actually said, which is follow your bliss. You might not be respected, but you will be in your own life. And Campbell had this notion of what he called the left path and the right, the left path and the right path. And the right path is into the culture. You know, the culture defines and you go into it. And it's very valuable because, you know, it gives you structure. Here's what I need to be successful. The left path is towards the feeling. You know, you live more towards the feeling of your own life. And when you arrive at that moment where you want to create more authenticity, you have to live more towards the feeling. And there's no structure. And it's difficult. And that's the thing about healing, about transformational processes, and about finding more meaning, is that this stuff is woo-woo, pie-in-the-sky shit, you know, until you start really going for it. And then you realize what discipline and courage it actually takes. you know, I live my best life. When you actually start trying to do that, you know, it takes discipline and courage. So that's, you're right. It's a deep thing to do, to try and find your harmony in life.
Amen to that and so much more. I think when I heard you talk about the way that you would get up in the morning and know that your ability to track an animal would actually impact the whole community and the survivorship of people around, and that fear of going out there with an intention of we should and need and must find an animal, with also the ability to know that it may not happen. And this courage that it takes to go into the wild and to walk into the unknown with, you know, you hear a cry, you hear a shout, you hear a roar, and you go, it may be next to this pond or it may not, but we're going to go there and we're going to keep, you know, I loved you talking about that. And I'll put in the show notes when you talked about these stories about, you know, how long do you pursue a track before you say it's dead or we got to go back, right? And how much that is a metaphor for people in their life saying, but Boyd, I've tried. Right? I've tried, and it just didn't work out. So I might as well just go back and conform to the life I was told I was supposed to have. Is that something that you can also relate to?
I mean, I relate everything to tracking, you know, and all transformational processes to tracking. And so exactly what you're saying, you know, all tracking begins in a very strange way where we know as trackers that there are animals out there, but we don't know where they are. We don't know where they're moving. We don't know if we'll find tracks. We have no idea what the day holds for us. And the beginning, you know, the first movement of all tracking, and if you watch a tracker, what they program into themselves is the capacity to begin without knowing. Every day they set off and hold a total unknown space of what might happen. And so what I started to see is in transformational processes, all transformational processes begin when we say, I know I want change, but I have no idea how that works. And actually becoming, or what that is, and actually becoming comfortable inside of not knowing. I've coached hundreds of people who, especially in the work and career space, who have said, well, when I know exactly what the next move for me is, then I'll go for it. And in my experience, you know, the discovery of the authentic life, it doesn't work like that. You have to make the space to not know and sit in that like a tracker. So go without knowing is always the first movement. The second part is you're going to need to develop track awareness, what we were talking about earlier. You have to teach yourself to see. You have to understand that there's information out there, but like a tracker, you have to start to tune into very specific signs and very specific, you know, as a tracker, it's scuff marks, pug marks, the way a foot falls on the ground. But as if you're in a transformational process, what I would say is you have to start to tuning into what makes you feel alive, what energizes you, the things that make you forget about time, what you're naturally curious about, yes, the people who make you feel expansive, how your body reacts in certain situations. If you're in a situation and you constantly feel yourself feeling constricted in your body, that's your body talking to you. If you hang out with certain people and you feel like literally an energetic expansive in your body, that's something to pay attention to. You're going to need constant first, what I would call first tracks. First tracks, you know, if you're out with a tracker and you're tracking a lion, for example, you'll get, you know, the lion could be anywhere in a vast wilderness. But if we have a first track, we have a beginning point, and then we have a next first track, and then a next first track. And so what I say to people in transformational processes is just work on the first track, and then the next first track, and then the next first track. You just need to know the next smallest thing you can do towards that feels a little better, that feels a little more alive, a little more expansive, because usually the whole path is not given to us. And, you know, maybe I'll tell a story here, Mark, about a story that I just read that goes to really where we began around the idea of homing. Transformational processes or finding the track of your life or your authentic life, it is a process of becoming, and it is a process of homing. It is not like I know exactly what I'm going to be and then I arrive there. Like, slowly you start to move towards it. And that's why tracking became such a powerful metaphor, because it's, you do this and then that leads you to this and then that leads you to this. I recently read a story about a native boy. This was a story that was written in the late 1800s by an anthropologist. A young native boy is kidnapped from his home, and they, which is on a piece of land. They blindfold him, and they take him by circuitous route, a journey of about 200 miles, on a train, then on a vehicle. And that journey ends about 60 kilometers or 60 miles from where he was originally kidnapped, but hidden by a mountain range. Sometime during the night, the boy escapes, and the next day when they track him, they find that he walks on an almost direct route back to his home through the mountains, that, and he's never left his home before. And when they find him, they say to him, how did you find your way home? And he just keeps repeating the refrain, I did not know where my home was. I wanted to go home. And the way that this anthropologist described it is, he said the boy was engaged in purposeful action towards an unknown purpose. And that's such a radical idea to me. He is walking, he has no idea where his home is, but something in him is walking himself home. And that is the capacity for homing. And so what I'm saying to people is, you don't know rationally what the full expression of your authentic life is, but something in you knows moment to moment what the next thing to do is. And part of where you'll trip yourself up is by trying to fully define, when I get here, then I'll feel good. Instead of being present and, like a tracker, just working on the next track that you know to have, and taking and doing the next subtle thing that feels a little more energizing, a little more joyful, a little more curious. And when you commit to that daily, over time, suddenly your life starts to change. That's my monologue. Love that's it. My diatribe.
Yeah, no, I love it. Boy, thank you so much. I love that. And I think, you know, it is, it's kind of follow the breadcrumbs. It's kind of what I used to explain to people is, don't focus on what the end result will be, because if you're attached to what the final outcome will be, you'll miss the life that you were meant to have. Like there's almost like you need to kill this idea of who you need to be in order to become what is deep inside of you yearning to be expressed. So I love that. And I'm also conscious of time, so I want to be respectful. Boyd, before I ask you one of my final questions, I just want to say a deep thank you, brother. Like genuinely, like I came across you by a total miracle, because Daniel Nichols, shout out to Danny, put you on my path by sharing your episode with Aubrey Marcus, and it's just one of these things where I feel like, I know it sounds really stupid, like we've never met in person or anything, but I just want to say thank you for the work you do, for healing one person at a time and ceremonies one group at a time, because I feel like that has a ripple effect, not just on the humans you're helping, but also the communities they're serving, the families they're leading, the colleagues they're working with. And there's no such thing as trivial small work. So I hope you know that. I hope you are appreciated, and a big deep help. Thank you for the work you do.
Mark, thank you so much. I appreciate that, man.
No, of course, man. And one of my final questions to you is, what does being unconventional mean to you?
I mean, being unconventional to me, I would say being unconventional has been my path. It means that instead of defining myself and trying to fit myself into the external models that are presented, I continuously go into myself and try and find from the inside what feels authentic to me and what feels like my harmony. And then I build ways to express that into the world. And so, you know, if you asked, you can't go to university to study how to be an animal tracker who used animal tracking to merge life guiding and work out how to weave in ceremonial spaces to create radical healing and transformation in as many people as possible. There's no course for that at university. I have found that those are the things that feed me, that nourish me. And then I've found a way to put them together so that I can express myself fully in the world. And so to be unconventional is to find your harmony and then do the challenging work of working out how to express yourself fully in those art forms. And it has been a hugely challenging, and it has taken time, but I am in a place now where it's really starting to flow through. And I just feel incredibly lucky to be in a life and a job and work out of something that feels so vocational to me, that was created out of sort of having a crazy idea for many years and starting to work out how it came together.
Yeah, and what I love about it is how every little detail of the story adds up. You know, at any point it could have derailed. Like, had you not erased the name of one of the guides and not had spoken, you know, and be seen, who knows where you would be, right? And that's not even the question, because you're here now. So I love that. Where can people find out more about you if they want to get in touch or buy your book? Because I know you've got an online program, Track Your Life. Where is the best place for people to go and connect with you?
Yeah, thanks, Mark. We are boydvarty.com. There are two books on there, The Lion Tracker's Guide to Life, which is it's the book I've written that I'm most proud of, mm-hmm. and Cathedral of the Wild. And then we've also just launched an online retreat, which is an 8 modules, which will help people develop the mindset and the mentality of an inner tracker, go inwards through a series of exercises. It's really dense content-wise. And it will help you find the track of your own life. I wanted to provide something to people that could be an introduction to doing this inner work and finding your way to this authentic track. So that's also on there. It's on boydvarty.com. It's our online retreat. And I hope it's going to help a lot of people learn this art form of going inward.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Boyd, I appreciate you. Thanks, brother, for coming on the show. I can't wait to put this out into the world. And anything I can do to support, you just let me know.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
There you have it, folks. I hope you enjoyed today's conversation as much as I did. As you can tell, we talked about some sensitive topics, so please take care of your needs if you want to reach out to some support. But it was an incredible reminder of why we need to tune back in before we feed from the outside world. How actually what our soul yearns for doesn't come from distraction and noise and accolades and achievements, but rather on what we're yearning and what we're hungry and curious for. So if you want to go and check out Boyd, please make sure to go and do that at boydvarty, that's VARTY.com. And you'll find all the resources there where you can look and check out his virtual retreat, his books, and all the upcoming events that he's coming. So I really appreciate Boyd coming on the show. I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you did, let me know. You can do so on social media, but also by leaving a rating on Apple Podcasts. It makes a huge difference. And if you enjoyed or got anything out of today's conversation, please share it with one friend. That's it. Just with one friend. That's the best way you can support the show. And it means the world to me. So as always, take care of yourself. Your message matters. Be true, be brave, be kind, and let it rip. I'll see you next time. Today's episode was brought to you by Become the Spotlight. If you're in business and you want to make a difference and make a bigger impact, you're going to have to learn how to engage and enroll your ideal audience. It turns out there are 5 principles that I've identified that every single most inspiring individual that's come on the podcast has. And you can have that too. You can figure out where you stand and how you benchmark according to these 5 principles for free. And it takes 3 minutes. And you can do that at www.becomethespotlight.com, where you're going to get an insight report and some steps that you can take to improve your score and improve your ability to stand out and make a difference with your story, your message, and your mission. I can't wait to see what score you get. Once you go through the score, let me know and tag me into social media, send me a DM. I really can't wait to see what you get. And more importantly, let's see what we can do to help you get an even higher number. I'll see you in there.